You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Music lovers, this is Modern Musicology. My name is Alan, and say hello to our two co-hosts, Stephanie Seymour.
Hello, everybody.
And Rob Levy.
Hey.
And this week, we have a very special guest that's joining us, Ian Wright, lead singer of the band The Jack Rubies. The band made their debut with a 7-song EP called Witch Hunting in Lotus Land, released in 1986. The Rubies then signed to TVT Records and released two full-length albums, Fascinating Vacation in 1988 and See the Money in My Smile in 1990. And now, 34 years later, they're back with a brand new album, Clocks Are Out of Time, on Big Stir Records. And we're very much looking forward to talking about all this stuff, the new album, the band's history and everything with Ian. Ian, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, I'm very pleased to be here. Good to talk to you guys. So, looking forward to this.
I'm like super excited. So.
Me too.
Well, then, Rob, why don't you just kick us off?
I guess I'll start with, you know, when you guys formed in 85, the UK music climate was kind of weird because you kind of had post-punk happening. C86 was kind of going on and all of that stuff. And you guys have a sound that is both kind of like it, but different, if that makes any sense. And I'm just kind of wondering how you guys navigated that musical terrain then to have your own sort of distinctive sound and the sort of edgy stuff you had going on.
No, yeah, I think that's true. We were sort of like, a round peg trying to get in a square hole kind of thing, or whatever that expression is, in that we were contemporaries particularly and did a lot of gigs and played the same venues as a lot of the what are now called the C86 bands. I mean, it wasn't called that then, of course. There was no sort of club name. And we were sort of loosely tagged into all that. But most of those bands were not in a Britpop way, but they were still very English. And we always had from the get-go, and it's just because of the kind of things we liked. It wasn't like a deliberate ploy, but we all were kind of, we liked all the sort of first wave of post-punk stuff. We loved Echo and the Bunnymen and, Television and The Fall and the Wire, all those bands. We loved all that, but we also kind of were interested and a bit sort of amused by what we ended up calling them the cowboy songs when we started trying to write the stuff that was influenced by it. But really, it was basically country music and the weird, dark underbelly kind of aspect of all that, which was so foreign to us, but we found it very intriguing. And so that was one of the early ingredients. It didn't stay with us all the way through, but the early version of the band, I mean, the title of that first EP or mini album, Witch Hunt in Lotus Land, had songs on there that were very, on one hand, you had some kind of poppy, quite straightforward C86 style songs, I suppose, like Give Up Everything, or that's one that sticks in my mind, or The Book of Love. But then we also had, Dallas Blues, the title track, Witch Hunt in Lotus Land. So there was all that going on as well. And I don't, it was not a deliberate ploy. It just evolved because of the mentality of the five people in the band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned Echo and the Bunnymen, which is one of my favorite bands. I think, to me, your sound is always like you've had like this dark kind of sense of humor in your lyrics, but also some kind of darkness musically, but also there's the poppy sound too. Just kind of like Echo and Nick Cave, maybe even like Peter Murphy.
I would certainly agree with Nick Cave and all his incarnations and Echo and the Bunnymen, etc. But I was also, that was in the ether. That kind of stuff was in the ether and everyone was taking from it to some degree. But I also have always enjoyed slightly tongue-in-cheek you know, wicked humor,
yes,
aspect of lyrics. I mean, I love the lyricists who might seem to be miserable, but are actually really funny. Nick Cave's one of them.
Yes,
he is. He can be hilarious, especially in his writing as he's gone on with the Bad Seeds and his solo stuff. But because he was more extreme in the Birthday Party days.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Certainly Nick Cave, Edwin Collins from Orange Juice.
Yes.
I mean, Morrissey, obviously, in his Smiths era. I loved all that kind of, you know, playing around with sort of tongue-in-cheek ideas. And, you know, that really appealed to me. And I think that's part of my sense of humor. My personal sense of humor is a little bit like that. So that was always going to be in there to temper the more dour, raincoat-wearing indie kids scowling all the time. You know, it was going to be a bit of both. And that was the recipe, which kind of evolved.
I thought the lyrics were always particularly not just tongue-in-cheek, but sort of like, you know, as you alluded to, happy melancholy, but they're a bit more highbrow too than some of the stuff the other people are doing at the time, just the way they're lyrically executed and things.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that is actually true. I think not necessarily speaking about myself, but certain members of the band were quite brainy. And so there was, I mean, Max, our drummer, was actually still studying for his university. He's still doing his college work when we started, and he was studying philosophy. So he's kind of like a real brainiac, and he would be spouting all kinds of, you know, out there philosophical notions, which we didn't even know the people he was talking about. But anyway, I do remember once somebody said, because our second single was called, I'm just jumping ahead a little bit now, but was called Lobster. And
yes,
that was about something Max told me about. Max, the drummer, was telling me about this guy called Nerval, who used to walk around Paris with a pet lobster on a leash. And that, you know, that's the kind of thing he would come up with. And that would kick me off into, like, you know, paroxysms of giggles. And then I'd write a song about it or get a lyric going on it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there was an element of us being hopefully not too highfalutin, but we did definitely take some lyrical ideas that were not the normal run of the mill stuff. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I always thought you were closer to the Godfathers too.
That's a good one.
Than like the Mighty Lemon Drops, if that makes sense.
It does. Yeah.
And kind of getting to that, it's funny you touched upon the country thing because I was going to bring that up. But when I saw you, you guys sort of came out and you looked very much like either a country band or like a very early 50s, like Bill Haley rockabilly kind of thing. And I'm just wondering how much of that aesthetic seep through, because the guitars almost sound in some places like they've been nicked from old rockabilly records.
When did you see us?
I saw you in St. Louis opening for They Might Be Giants.
Okay, yeah.
And then I saw you opening for Modern English.
Oh, okay.
And then on the second tour, the See the Money in My Smile, I saw you on that tour when you headlined.
Okay. Now, I was going to say, because when we started, so going back to the Witch Hunt and Lotus Land period and the first crop of indie singles we did in the UK, pre-TVT records, we definitely had, that was another thing that's made us stick out a little bit from all the other crop of bands, because we did start wearing vaguely rockabilly type, 50s type gear, kind of deliberately to separate ourselves from, because we weren't a rockabilly band, although that was an element in some of the songs. But we wanted to look different to all the other geezers playing, you know, in their torn t-shirts and jeans, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that was another factor. So that was definitely in there. But by the time we got to America, so it's a few years down the line, we were still wearing that kind of stuff when we started. And I just remember it was became completely impractical because of the heat. So by the end of those tours, we were all in shorts, you know, on stage looking like a certain ratio. But I'm kind of going off the point a little bit, maybe. But certainly the rockabilly is another, you know, rockabilly slash country music, that kind of Americana, it's not Americana, but that American influence was part of our thing too. Yeah, for sure. Coupled with the very English sensibility. I mean, that was kind of what we were doing.
Since we're kind of talking about that first release, Witch Hunt in Lotus Land.
Yeah.
When you go you sign on to TVT and you do your first two albums, and some of the songs from that first EP get re-recorded for those next two albums. And I'm thinking specifically of Book of Love, Dallas Blues, Wrecker of Engines, and there's a couple more. And I'm just curious to know if you remember, how did you pick those songs to re-record and not all of them? Or was there something in those songs that were special?
No, actually what happened was, it's you may not realize this, but our first TVT album, which was called Fascinating Vacation, was actually, truly, after Witch Hunt in Lotus Land, in the period between that and signing to TVT and doing those two albums, there was about an 18-month period where we had a publishing deal. We had quite a good publishing deal with Warner Chappell Music, but we didn't have a label. And they created a kind of in-house label around us and a couple of other bands, even though they're not a record label. And we put out a series of indie singles. They were all 12-inch singles, and each had three or four tracks on. And that we did four of them. And the cream of that material, virtually all of it, was what TVT gathered up. And really, it's a compilation of our English singles, but it was sold in this country. It was only released in America originally. Mm-hmm. Was sort of put forward as the debut album. So those tracks that you just mentioned, Book of Love, actually not Book of Love, that's a different story, but certainly Dallas Blues, Wrecker of Engines are the ones I can remember.
God, I love that song. That's such a great song.
thank you. But those were re-recorded at our choice to be, Wrecker of Engines became a single, the second version of it. And Dallas Blues was, I think that was the B-side of Wrecker of Engines as the single later on. So it wasn't a TVT thing. It wasn't like, okay, boys, I need you to re-record these songs. That did happen with Book of Love, because that was on, you know, that was the first track on the very first record. And it had been a live stalwart part of the set for the whole time. And it had developed a lot from that first recording. I like that early recording. It's kind of very jingly jangly. And it has a very different feel to the later full-on turbocharged, searing Neil Young-esque guitar solo version, was what had happened in its development over a year, 2 years, playing it live all the time. And TVT were like, you need to re-record that how you do it now. So that certainly is true of that song.
It is, to me, it's very interesting to go back and listen to the original versions of those songs and the way that they were re-recorded and how much they changed and evolved just in that short amount of time.
Me too.
Getting
me
into
too,
the studio for those albums.
I agree. The funny thing is that, you know, Dallas Blues, which, sort of a tongue-in-cheek theme song for the band. I suppose I'm not denying we kind of wrote it because we named ourselves the Jack Rubies. But that we couldn't, you know, I still prefer the original version of it, the sort of more hoedown, kind of slightly acoustic-y version. The original version is still my favorite. But we played it live a lot, and we had, in fact, it was even a live version was put out on a compilation at one point that, it's not in the catalog anymore, but we couldn't. We were trying to get the best of both worlds when we re-recorded it for TV or for the single later on. We're trying to get the sense of that original acoustic-y but more jingly jangly kind of hootenanny version with all the kind of over the top ad-libbing and feedback that we had finally got the place it had got to, but I don't think we ever quite succeeded. So I still there's three versions floating out around there in various forms. I still like the first one best, which was kind of like literally almost live in the studio, and we hardly knew the song when we did it. But I still like it the best, actually, all these years later.
Since you mentioned calling yourself the Jack Rubies, I don't know the story behind the name of the band. So why did you call yourselves the Jack Rubies? And I think that kind of goes along with the thing that Stephanie was talking about earlier about this dark sense of humor that goes through your music. I think it is right there in the name of the band as well.
I guess so. I mean, I'll tell you the true story and a couple of the made up ones because we
I like that. Okay.
We want the lies.
We got asked that question so much in the States. I mean, in the UK, it was never so much of an issue for interviews and things, because the true story is when we literally were first forming and we hadn't got a name, and or we might have had a we might have done a couple of gigs under a different name, and we didn't, you know, sort of just pick the name on the night kind of thing. But when we were actually no records, very few gigs under our belt, but we're thinking we've got to get a good name. And the true story is that we were all lazing around in our shared band house, which was a squatted house in East London. And we were playing Trivial Pursuits in the middle of the afternoon with the TV on, with daytime television on in the background, and smoking cigarettes and drinking cups of tea, as you do. And one of the questions was, in the Trivial Pursuits game, was who was the perpetrator of the first live TV assassination? Mm. Answer, Jack Ruby. Of whom we vaguely knew who he was. We obviously knew who Lee Harvey Oswald was historically, and JFK. We knew the whole Dallas thing, but the Jack Ruby thing for British people, at least then, when maybe there wasn't so much. Well, there certainly wasn't the internet huge conspiracy, you know, mega theories going on all the time. It was a smaller world, so we kind of knew it was something to do with it, and. It wasn't like that's a sort of notorious figure, let's use that. It was more like, well, if we make that rubies, as in gems, it kind of looks good, the Jack Rubies, and it sounds good, and it's got a slight cachet of naughtiness about it. Let's go with that, because we got a gig at the weekend down the place at the end of the road, and so that's, and it stuck, and people liked the name in England in the indie scene, and that was, you know. It was kind of a good one. But of course, at the time, we had no idea of the potential repercussions of the name if we were ever going to end up in America, which we had no idea about at the time.
Going to Dallas playing a gig.
Oh, God. And we played Dallas, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. But we never played that song on tour in America. I don't think. We might have done it once or twice, but we were a bit nervous about it. And get this, Jack Ruby's surviving brother, I don't know if he's still alive now, he was called Earl Ruby, wrote to us, and he was a dry cleaner in, I forget from where, but saying how much he appreciated us keeping his name alive and fully supported what we were doing. And this was a freak out, I'm telling you. Because he sent it to the publishing company, to Warner Chappell, and they were all in hoots about it. But I wasn't so bemused. I was like, well, this could be a bit nutty, you know. Yeah. Anyway.
How's Earl's mental state?
You know, I don't know if he's even still around, but I haven't told that story for a long time, but it's absolutely true. Wow. So anyway, we kind of started devising, partially because we were being asked the question all the time, and we were kind of, you know, cheeky young lads. So we started making up these other stories apart from the true story. And the sort of slightly lame one was that, no, it's nothing to do with Jack Ruby, the historical figure. It's that's the name of an English dessert called like a fruit tart. It's called a Jack Ruby.
Nice.
That was the one that one didn't go that far. But the one that did, we used to say that, the band formed because we were cast in a student's film called The President's Brain is Missing. And we were this band called the Jack Rubies. And it was nothing to do with us naming it. We were named by the filmmaker. And the film never made it off the cutting room floor, but we decided to keep the name and keep going. That one made it into loads of interviews. We just would do it straight-faced. And so for a while, I think we forgot what the true story was, but it is the Trivial Pursuits one.
It's basically Trivial Pursuit.
It's a great story, and it's much more rock and roll than saying we were just sitting around playing Trivial Pursuit one afternoon.
Mm. And just really quickly, just because I said we did play, I don't know if we played once or twice in Dallas. We certainly played there once, and I believe it was a quite a big venue because it was on one of the tours we were opening up for, probably Modern English. And, you know, Max, again, goes back to Max, the drummer. He insisted on putting his cymbals not in this position, but in this position, sort of like, I think he got that from Ringo Starr, who said, you know, when John Lennon was like, when they were in the phase of like, you know, we're bigger than Jesus and all that was going on, Ringo would always put his cymbals like this, apparently. Max had read this somewhere. And so he did that. And of course, left me completely exposed, but actually it went very well. And, but we didn't play that song though.
He had shields up, right?
Yeah. So I think on the whole, you know, no one ever got really kind of upset about it over here. But I think at the end of the day, most people realize it's just some English lads pulling our legs and, you know, being a little bit naughty. And that kind of is what it was.
How did you then hook up with, was Warner Chappell your hookup there with TVT? And how did that, I know that you just had two records out basically on TVT and then
yeah,
kind of left.
Well, I think what happened was, you know, Warner Chappell really liked us and were very encouraging. And that, you know, kind of funded the band for a while because it was, a big company. And, you know, we were living very simply, but it was enough to mean that we didn't have to, we had, you know, odd day jobs and stuff, but we could actually exist to some extent as a band and concentrate on that. But they weren't a record label. And even though they enabled us to put out these series of 12-inch singles, they were always shopping around for us to try and get on a proper label. And there were a number of possibilities with some English labels that came up. The one that we always regretted, because we kind of messed it up, I think, was Go Discs. You know, were very interested in us at that time. And we had many meetings with them. And it's all a bit lost in the ether now, exactly what happened. But something happened maybe where it just didn't happen when it should have done, and it started to cool off. And the next thing we know, they'd signed the Lars or the Lars.
The Lars,
and that
yeah.
Was like, okay, so that was that. But anyway, there were a number of labels looking at us, but no one totally bit. But TVT were kind of obsessed with that song, Be With You, and the first song it was our first single as well that was not on Witch Hunt. And so I think it went something like this. They had that single first to license it in the States and see how it did. And it did become sort of, I guess, a college radio fave. Yes. And the video for it was quite good. And that got on to 120 minutes into rotation. And so over a period of time, this idea came up that TVT would license all the English singles, or most of the tracks. And it was still a licensing deal, and do Fascinating Vacation. And it did pretty well, I think. I mean, I can't give you figures. It's too much time's gone by. But it did well enough for them to say, we want to offer you a proper deal. We want another album with all brand new material. And we want you to go in, you know, we want a good producer, good high-end studio with a name producer, which turned out to be Pat Collier, who's done a lot of, you're all nodding, so you know who I'm talking about. But yeah, he was a member of the Vibrators, but then had a really burgeoning producing career, which I think he's still doing, with a lot of great bands, House of Love and the Darling Buds. I'm sure you know anyway. My Bloody Valentine, I think he worked with possibly in their earlier days. But anyway, it was great to be involved with him. So that's what happened. That's the second album. See the Money in My Smile was the big new album in our world. It was our debut album, but in their world it was the second album,
right?
Yeah.
So I guess what happened after that, you guys parted ways, and then for many years you were not together as a band. Yeah.
I mean, basically TVT were really good. I mean, I guess technically they were an independent label, but they were not like, doing out of somebody's back parlor or whatever. It was like they had New York, the Manhattan offices. It was pretty posh, and they had a lot of good connections, and they had Trent Reznor at the time. And so all that was happening, and they really, in terms of promotionally getting the Jack Rubies out there, I can't fault them. They did an amazing job. And during the honeymoon period of Fascinating Vacation and the tours that followed that, going into and the making of See the Money in My Smile, you know, labels were a bit different then in the fact that they didn't mind trying to interfere a little bit. You know, we had to resist that sometimes when they would want as much say in what material we were going to record as we did. And I mean, you know, it's nothing that anybody else didn't have going on at the time, same time as well. But, you know, we did have our ups and downs with them. There's no doubt about that. But in the long term, you know, we came off the road after really touring most of 1990 and with some intervals, but a lot of time on the road all in the States. And we were like, we want to get off the road. We want to start writing the new record thinking that's what we were going to be doing. Mm-hmm. But they were very resistant. And they were like, you know, they didn't say, okay, guys, you dropped. They were like, no, more demos, but not in a studio. Here's a four-track Tascam machine to do it on. And, you know, it was like everything was going down mm-hmm. a notch. And it was like, and no real money to, you know, sort of exist in terms of, you know, it's like, get yourselves day jobs.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it was like, which some of us did. So there was a period of kind of detente, or whatever. I don't know if that's the right expression, but they were deciding what to do with us. Mm-hmm. We were kind of being left a bit up in the air. Warner Chappells was scratching their heads going, what's going on with TVT Records? Because, you know, guys, if you don't, you know, I hate to say it, but if you don't fulfill the minimum thing in the contract where you've got to produce some new masters by this date, yeah. we have to drop you. We said, and we, you know, and that's actually what happened. They did drop us. Okay. Warner Chappells, we were still technically signed to TVT, but we hadn't been able to do any more recording. And it just sort of fizzled out. I don't even know if there was ever a day when they said, you are dropped, but we just assumed that we were. And the band, it was so demoralizing for the band how that all kind of fell to bits. There's five in the band, so four of them went back to England. I was kind of adrift here. I managed to scrape up a kind of off the books job so I could live here in the East Village very cheaply. And I thought, I'm just going to stay in New York for as long as I can to try and see what's going on with TVT, see if we can rectify the situation, you know. And I would have meetings with them, and it was all beating around the bush. It was very frustrating. Mm-hmm. And eventually I did go back to England, by which time one of the band members, Stephen Einson, who's the other guitarist and songwriter, he's just had enough. He quit. And I, you know, I understand. So that was sort of the writing on the wall. The four remaining members, including me, we did try to carry on for a bit in the UK. We did a few shows, but we also had returned to England in the height of the whole sort of rave acid house dance scene. And that was like, bloody hell. Okay, got grunge on one hand, and we got this on the other. We don't fit in here at all, you know. So it came to a amicable, I mean, but sorry end. And we all sort of went our separate ways. And thankfully, we managed to keep our friendships, but which continued to this very day. But it was a tough time. It's a tough time. And then really what happened was everybody went off in five different directions and we all needed time away from each other. Actually, that's what happened. The bass player, Steve Brotway, came back to the States in 91 with me. And we tried to sort of, it wasn't going to be the Jack Ruby's Mark II, but we tried to sort of see what a next phase might be. We weren't sure what it was. And we did a few different projects, but my heart wasn't really in it. And I can, at certain points, you know, probably after that thing I did with the Matter Rose guys, or the Matter Rose and Paul guys, I just said, which was fun. Actually, that was a really fun project. But I just said, you know, I'm just going to stop doing this. I don't think it's going to be permanent. I'm stopping.
Yeah.
But then I didn't do anything for 25, 30 years. So there you go.
Wow.
The others did things. The others did some various things, but for me, I just, well, you know what I did do? I just went into something completely different and I started a business in art restoration, and that just took over my life for 25 years. So
I was going to ask you about that, because I did read that you said you went, I guess you went to art school, is that correct? And then you decided to use that?
I mean, I didn't train specifically to do art restoration, as in, it was basically paper works, whether they be vintage posters or old documents, or not photographs, but anything that's on paper that was ephemera of some kind or another. I didn't specifically train for that as a student, but when I was trying to figure out what to do, I kind of fell into doing it here. A friend of mine was working for a studio that did that, and I, you know, I didn't even know really what it was as a discipline. But I learned pretty quick on the job, and a few years later, just started doing my own version. Mm. It was kind of just me and this other guy, and we were kind of regarded as a bit like, you know, the rock and roll upstarts who started their own studio and challenging, because there were three or four quite big restoration houses in New York at that time. There aren't any more, but wow. But anyway, it was kind of like a gamble. It could have fallen flat on its face, but because we were new on the block and we were offering attractive pricing, it went from strength to strength for a while, for 10 years. And then it carried on going after that initial 10 years, but it wasn't quite as firing on all cylinders at that time. But that's it's another story.
Wow. That's so cool.
So that just took up all my time. And I suppose that became my creative outlet. And it kind of reinforced the idea that, no, I'm not going back to music. I don't want to be demoralized and try and start a band and the proverbial audience of three people and their pet dog. You know, I just didn't want to do that or have the time, because I know from being in a band, and you know this too, Stephanie, I'm sure. I don't know if the other two guys were in bands at all, but you know that you have to just completely dedicate everything to it to get anywhere and be a bit selfish and have kind of tunnel vision. And I couldn't do that. So I
yeah. And it's also hard. Like, I mean, we should talk offline sometime. We had a very similar situation that you did about the slow decline from the label, but that also takes a lot out of you. And so to think about going back to that and starting in. So then how did you get back into that mindset?
Well, I never thought I would. I really didn't. I thought that's initially going back to what you just said, it was very traumatic because I felt like, well, that wasn't where we were going to stop. We got all this other stuff we wanted to do. So for a year or two, I was kind of a little bit embittered about it. And I didn't want to think about, I eventually got to a point where I didn't even want to think about the Jack Rubies. I just focused on this business idea. And one of the nice byproducts of that was I gradually became a big fan of music again, because I think, I don't know about you, but I think that when you're in a band, you get very competitive, or I do, and you become less of a fan of music. And I love music. I love all kinds of music. And when that was no longer such an issue that I've got to do better than those guys, or I really started to embrace music again. So I certainly redeveloped my love of music, and that was a real plus. So I became a big fan. Went to a lot of shows eventually, not straight away, but eventually went to a lot of shows, and just really embraced all that side of it. And occasionally, I don't mind admitting, I would fantasize about the idea of us getting back together, but I didn't feel like getting my guitar out of the cupboard. And one of the, but Steve Einson, the guy who left when we were in the doldrums, he was the one probably of all of us who'd done the most to keep going. He formed a band, it was really an Americana band. He formed a band called the Milagro Saints, sort of mid-90s-ish. And he basically was leading that band until probably only a few years ago. And that, so I thought, well, he's doing that. He's really enjoying it. I'm really happy that he's doing it. But I didn't think in any scenario he'd drop that and say, let's reform the Jack Rubies. So that was another thing. Well, it's not going to happen anyway. So I might occasionally fantasize about it. All right. I occasionally have this recurring dream where we were all in the van together trying to get to a gig and we could never get there. So I thought that's true, you know, but that all that stuff faded away eventually. And we were all on speaking terms. Sometimes it was sporadic. Sometimes years would go by and we wouldn't see that much of each other or talk that much because we were all doing different things in our lives. But we did all stay in touch. And really the catalyst for ever doing anything again began as a concentrated kind of campaign by ourselves to, well, one, get the rights back to the TVT albums because they were out of print since TVT went bankrupt in mid 2008, I think. You couldn't hear those anywhere except on if you bought a secondhand copy on Discogs or something. There was no social media presence because we'd just been completely apathetic about it for one reason. We just hadn't embraced any of that, you know. So, how does Facebook work again? It's like, we just didn't do it. And so I think it was me. I have to say it was me who was the driving force. But eventually, having not wanted to think about the band for all those years, started eventually to start weeding through whatever artifacts I had, whether it be, you know, old tapes and videos, paraphernalia from the press, whatever, photographs. Mm-hmm. And the first thing I did was, because what I did do at art school was study filmmaking. It was one of the things that I was mainly doing. So the first thing I did, and this is going back, say, you know, 2016, 17, maybe, I started cleaning up all the old videos and all the footage we had.
Oh, wow.
And started to just created a YouTube channel and just got that out there just for fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was it. We had a Jack Ruby's YouTube channel. It was like an archive, just for the legacy. And gradually the others came on board and they all had different talents in terms of how to use social media. So we eventually started a Facebook page, started Instagram, started Twitter. We started doing all these things. And it eventually, it was a learning curve. So this is all going into the sort of 16, 17, 2019 sort of period. It led us to, although we didn't have the rights to the TVT albums, we did have the rights to Witch Hunt, some of the British singles that were not used by TVT, and Odds and Ends and stuff that was never released that were masters. So we did have all that stuff. So we started remastering them and self-releasing them as you can. We didn't, at first, we didn't know how you even do that. How do you get this stuff on Spotify? You know, we didn't even know. But we figured it out, and it was a total learning curve. And there we were, and I thought, that's it. That's job done, guys. We've got a presence back on in the world. We haven't been forgotten. There's a small little fan club who interact with all this stuff. It's great. Let's job done. And then COVID came, and Max, being the kind of cheerleader, instigator, says, "Ah, come on, guys, we've got to try writing some new songs now." Like a lot of people did in that period. I mean, it's a true story that many artists and many people had to rethink how to do stuff or start again in some regard, you know. And he was really up. Max has got his own studio. Max is like a real tech whiz kid. So he's got a very classy home studio. And he records other bands and things. So he had all that. Steve Einson had sort of broken up the Milagro Saints. He sort of was coming on board saying, we should do something. Yeah, I like this idea. We should do it. It's just a little project. So that was an important aspect for me, that all five of us would be involved. But, you know, the different attitudes in the band ranged from a bit skeptical, and I was one of them, to like, come on, we've got to do this. But we agreed. My main thing was, I don't know if I can write any songs. I haven't played my guitar really in way more than a decade. So there was it didn't come together at the drop of a hat. It was basically took a while to sort of figure out if it was even going to work. But there was a turning point as I started to remember how much I really adored writing songs and why I'd deprived myself of that. I'd forgotten about it. And, you know, I was rudimentarily sort of trying to relearn the guitar. And as I was doing that, I mean, I think I'm, you know, back where I was now. But to start with, I was like, well, I'm just going to figure out things on one string and find a nice little melody and figure out a vocal melody with that. And, there were a lot of stops and starts. But eventually I came up with something that everyone said, that's really good. Let's flesh it out. And they were all much more up to speed with their instruments. That song was Poltergeist. And it sort of evolved from an iTunes demo I did, not an iTunes demo, an iPhone demo, which I just did on my phone. That's not the final recording of it that came out, but that's where it started. And we all thought, that's okay. And then that started the whole thing turning again. And we still said, no one's ever going to hear any of this unless we're totally happy with it. But over a kind of a two-year period, say I think late 21 up to middle of 23 when we'd finished with it, we started writing songs. And there were some, you know, majority is just from scratch. There were a few bits and bobs from the old days that we kind of revamped and or welded together with something else. But that's kind of what happened. And suddenly we were like, this is actually pretty good. I think this stands up with the old stuff, and it's different too.
Did you guys go back and forth on sending stuff over the internet, basically, or were you getting together in the studio, in his studio?
Well, certainly in the COVID period, which was where it all started. I mean, it wasn't the height of COVID, but it was still difficult to, because two of the band live in the UK, Max and the percussion player. The bassist lives near me. We're both in the New York area, and Steve Einson's down in North Carolina. So we did get together in dribs and drabs, or rather in twos and threes, but predominantly in the start of it, it was swapping files. We were working remotely, and seeing how that actually worked. I mean, I didn't have a home studio set up. Max had to help me kind of learn that. So there was a lot of learning going on. But Max is so good in the studio. That was kind of the hub. He would just really go to town on these early files that were being sent around. And when it started to move and start to snowball a bit, I would then go over to the UK, work with him in his studio. We'd bring Lawrence in, who didn't live far from, he's the percussion player, bring Lawrence in. Over here, I would work with Steve, the bass player, at my end, and sometimes with Steve Einstein. So we, all five of us have not been in a room together, which is extraordinary. But wow. We've all been in various little groupings, you know. So, and that was one of the other things that kind of made it feasible to do, because if we'd thought of doing this, say, let's say 10 years ago, there wasn't the technology. There was some technology like this, but there wasn't the level of recording quality. I mean, you have to have somebody who knows what he's doing. He or she knows what they're doing with the technology, but it didn't exist in those sort of garage band days, if you know what I mean. So that all lined up. As I say, all members of the band were in places in their lives where we've got time to do it. And it was sort of like, let's get the old gang back together and see what happens. You know, I almost was kicking myself thinking, is this really what we're doing? It's mad. I'm not going to have that dream anymore. We can't get to the gig. Actually, we're doing something. Or did I die? And this is actually a parallel universe. So anyway, I'm just trying to communicate how the five of us have been totally energized and thrilled by it, you know, from baby steps to now, you know.
Just the process of getting a hold of your recordings and out there whole process of it. Because that to me seems like it's the real beast, right? If you're still friends and you're not fighting with like somebody in the band over who wrote what or whatever, that's the first easy hurdle to jump. But this idea of getting a hold of masters and fighting through all that stuff, that must have been like crazy and insane.
It was. Why we had a slight advantage, I suppose. Well, we didn't know who owned that. We didn't know if anybody owned the masters, because all we knew was TVT broke up, and let's say 2008. I'm not sure if it was that year, but they went bankrupt. They sold off all their assets, and if you go, we were doing our own kind of detective work online, and it would list a lot of the bands who were on the label that we knew, and they so and so has this in an archive and da da da. But our name was never coming up. And we're thinking, well, maybe we just got lost in the shuffle. And the other thing was that I had masters for all the British singles because it was licensed to TVT. So they never got the masters. I had them. So cool. We had those masters for the first album. We just were too scared to put them up because we thought, you know, if there is somebody, you get a strikeout at Spotify and you're fucked, basically. And I didn't have the masters to the master to see the money, but I did have the safety copy, which we deliberately kept it and never told TVT.
So great. Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah. So we had perfectly good masters. And then what we did, and we got a music biz lawyer to help us. They said, look, can you do the detective work and find out what's going on? And she eventually found out that who had the masters. And she, you know, there's this thing, I don't know if you guys know all about it, and it's probably quite boring legalese to go into for very long, but there is a loophole in the copyright law in the, you know, the US copyright law, where if you're, it's not just music, it's any kind of artistic endeavor, after 35 years, you have every right to get to retain, to get your rights back, but you have to jump through a bunch of hoops to do that. You can't just say, hey, 35 years have gone by, give it back. You've got to petition and do these things within a 2-year period before the date comes. And it's like, I'm kind of, you know, paraphrasing a bit, but you have to do things by certain dates or it's not going to happen. Hmm. Anyway, she guided us all through that. And we didn't get any, you know, she said, two things are going to happen. You're going to get pushback. And if you get pushback, that means you've got to go to court and you don't want to do that, right? I said, no, we don't want to do that. Says, or they might do nothing. And if they don't do it by a certain date, you're free and easy. Mm. Or they may say, well, we want to offer we have to have first refusal on a new deal. And that's up to you whether you want to engage with that. Well, nothing happened. It was all, nobody ever got back to us and never did anything. But when we got involved with TVT, who are fantastic, by the way, one of the things that we were talking about was, and you know, we're trying to get the rights back to the two old albums. We haven't got them yet, but you know, the dates are nearly there. The dates have almost rolled around when they do become ours. And they got excited about that. They didn't commit to it straight away, but they got excited about that. And they have a deal with The Orchard for their distribution. Yes. And turns out, certainly, it was a factor in us being able to get the rights back because they were all on board with it. The Orchard had the rights. Well, you know, it worked out.
And so, wow. That's fantastic.
It's a crazy story, but you know, I perhaps am talking out of turn, giving you all the background. But it's a done deal. We got them back, and we got their blessing to. So you know, TVT's like, well, you know, oh, sorry, TVT, Big Stir's like, well, they're just sitting mouldering in an archive. We can just start turning these. We can use these right now. Let's go. I said, yeah, okay.
Wow.
So that's what happened. Yeah. But that was the catalyst for us even really moving slowly towards a point where we decided to make some new music.
A moment ago, you were talking about the process of getting the band back together, basically, and writing new material. And you were determined that nobody would hear it until you felt like the new material sort of matched up with the old material. And I just want to say that as I was listening through all three of these albums over the past week, I really feel like, you know, because like, anytime a band gets back together after a long period of time, that band's fans want to hear the continuation from the old stuff. They want to hear the band now sounding like the band did back then. And I really think you captured that really well. I think that the stuff on the new album just slots right in with the stuff from the first two albums. And I'm thinking specifically of things like Hark and Heaven Shook Me and Corrupted and Poltergeist. I think that that stuff just captures that sound that people who would have been fans back in 88 and 90 would absolutely recognize as Jack Ruby's.
I hope so. Yeah. And I think, you know, I've just firmly of the opinion that it just comes out the way it comes out because of the chemistry with us five. I mean, it's the different way of working has influenced the sound a little bit in a good way, I think, in the fact that we worked partially remotely rather than all being in the studio at the same time. And or honing material on the road, which we used to do a lot. So this was like, it was more like, you know, this is the only version of the song and we've never played it live. But that aspect gave it a slightly, is it a modern twist on it? I don't know, but it's a slightly different twist on the sound of the earlier phase of the band. But the songs still coming from the same place and we just, it's just the way it comes out when we play these songs. I mean, I agree. I think, so, you know, it sits easily with the two earlier albums. And you could almost interchange some of the tracks, not all of them, but some, you could see, I could see some of the tracks you just mentioned that could have been on the See the Money album. I mean, for example, you know,
It's easily, like you said, but it is at the same time a modern record.
Yes.
It's not like stuck in the past is what I'm saying. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, like Shark Attack, I assume that's about COVID or that's that whole.
Yeah, or it's about kind of because of the time we were writing in, COVID concerns and general dystopian woes were in the air, you know, they were in the ether for us to take that. I mean, I wanted to write about some of that stuff, but Shark Attack, yeah, that was another early one of the new songs in that I think COVID was starting to wind down, but it was more like, when's the next weird thing going to be?
Right.
It was like, okay, it's all very well. I think, you know, we don't have to have quite as stringent lockdown procedures, but what's around the corner? It's like everything's different now, you know?
Yeah.
And at that point, that's how it felt, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You talked a minute ago about these are songs that you've not played live before. Is that going to happen? Is there going to be some Jack Ruby's gigs coming up?
That is the question, isn't it? We're certainly talking about it. And everyone in the band wants to do some gigs. How practical it is, we're trying to explore. Because touring is an expensive proposition. Even though it's one way the bands can make money, it's still an expensive proposition. And what it would be you know, if we all lived around here or in one location, it's a no-brainer. We'd just do some warm-up shows and see how it felt,
right,
just locally. But what this really means is, if we were going to come here, there's three of us here. So if two of the guys have got to fly over here, live and be accommodated for probably a good few weeks, at least a week, maybe longer, to rehearse.
Yeah,
because we haven't rehearsed. Right. We may know the songs, but we haven't, you know. And that's, you know, it's not like we did it 2 years ago. We haven't done it for 25 plus years, or it's longer than that. And so there's the rehearsal time, and then there is, you know, living on the road for, you know, even if we did a very toe in the water sort of East Coast sweep of 5 or 6 dates, you know, as a first, see how it works out. And that's probably the most logical thing to do to start with. I think it can be done, but we're trying to figure out the logistics of it. I mean, we don't have an agent now. We don't have, you know, New York's not a problem. I could get gigs in New York for us, but we're exploring how to do, you know, Boston, DC, Philly, New Jersey, as you know, that. And I think it's doable. So if there's any agents out there listening to this show, get in touch, because or club owners who might be interested. Because I think once we put a foot in the water, or if, you know, hopefully both feet in the water, it's definitely doable. And if that goes well enough, you know, I think we would all, it's definitely an unfulfilled ambition of all of us to do that again. Yeah, we would really
That's really exciting.
Yeah. So, Ian, I'm curious, before all of this rejuvenation story happened, what were your general thoughts of bands that had been broken up for a very long time and then getting back together? Were you pro that, or were you wait and see that?
Well, I wasn't pro it, no. I always thought that the usual thing that happens, it seems to me, is that if a band breaks up, then they may reform if there's enough call for it on an anniversary, or maybe, you know, maybe up to 10 years later, something like that. But we've gone way out. We're way away from that, you know. And I never particularly was that enamored when bands, some of our contemporaries, I can't think of a specific name right now, but some of our contemporaries who were, you know, were not huge, but they decided to reform, you know, 10 years ago after being split up for 10 years. But it was demoralizing, and it didn't really... They should have just left well alone, kind of thing. It was my view at that time. And that's one of the reasons why we never talked about reforming ever until, you know, I mean, we have reformed in a kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? In hyperspace, haven't we? We definitely regard ourselves as having reformed, but we're still like, you know, haven't taken that final step of all being in the same room together. Whether it's it be so in a wild. Rehearsal or, I know it's crazy, but I, you know, in the same way that I never thought we would ever work together again in any capacity, I didn't, and since we have, I now absolutely embrace the idea of playing live again. But my feeling in the past has been, it's not such a great idea usually.
Mm. Yeah. Because I'm generally not a fan of when my favorite bands break up and they get back together again, because usually it's kind of lackluster. But oddly enough, with you guys, I was never sort of dubious. I don't know whether it's just because you guys were so different than everybody else and that it wasn't such a formula, or if it's just the rest of the world has caught up with your sort of aesthetic, with the way the lyrics are and the way it all comes together, where it's not Catherwheel, it's not the Mighty Lemon Drops, it's different, it's not this or that. So maybe the rest of the world is caught up with you or not, but I just think it's interesting that, like, we live in this time where, like, any band that played and had three hits, whether they were all big hits or small hits in the 1980s, is now reunion.
It's
like reunions have been done to death.
That's right.
So somehow you have navigated that culture well, which is huge. And then you've also navigated that culture without, like, having to, like, send the guitarist to go talk to the drummer because you don't want to talk to him and stuff like that. It's like everybody's chill, which is amazing. It's a really unique and interesting story.
I agree. And that is the case. You know, we all love each other, and it's like the band of brothers, and we may not see each other for years on end, but we always just pick it up from, like, the last time we saw each other. And some of those reunions we were just talking about of other bands, that often is the case. You know, you need go-betweens between different members of the band, and it's just ridiculous. And it's not the same as it was when it was in its first run. And also, you know, it's not lost on us, the kind of irony of it. That's partially why we decided to call the album what it's called, Clocks Are Out of Time, because we've done this all the wrong way around. It's like totally screwy in terms of like what you're supposed to do and if you want to try and pick your career up again. But maybe in a nutty kind of way, it's perfect timing. I don't know. It seems like for some reason, I mean, I know the 80s are having a moment and, you know, they've been having a moment for a long time, but, you know, we certainly were not relevant in the grunge / dance rave years and probably not in the Britpop years either, because although we've got quite a lot in common with those bands, not in the sort of super English way, but some of the lyrics, I mean, I'm not thinking of the Blur Oasis thing so much, but more like, you know, bands like, I don't know, maybe don't consider them Britpop, but the bands like the O'Tours, do you know those guys, Luke Haynes and all that? Yeah, I mean, I think that his songwriting, again, is like kind of up my alley. It's like slightly sardonic and, it appeals to me. Anyway, but the point being, we wouldn't have fitted into that era either. It's something not quite the same as that, although it has some touchstones in there. And for whatever reason, what we sound like has in some ways become almost current again. And it's that's just timing. The timing is weird and the clocks are out of time, but here we are. And that's all I know about it.
Kismet.
Yeah.
Hey, Leah.
Hey, Sean.
You know what now is a good time for?
What's that?
A promo for the Soul Forge podcast.
The Soul Forge? What's that?
Oh, it's a show. It's a podcast all about sex and dating.
Love and relationships.
Pop culture and movie reviews.
Adventure.
Almost anything you can think of.
Definitely.
What is it?
The Soul Forge.
The Soul Forge podcast.
Think about it.
Ian, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experiences and telling your stories. It's been such an enjoyable hour just listening to all the stuff that you've had to say. And congratulations on getting the band back together and a fantastic new album. So people should go and check you out on Spotify and they should follow you on your socials. Can you talk a little bit more about your social presence and where people can find you?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, as far as getting the music, we're on all the regular streaming services that you know. And you can certainly go to the Big Stir site as well, where there's a lot of information and news there, and all the music's there. As far as the socials are concerned, you know, we have Twitter or X, Hex, whatever it's called now. Twitter.com/thejackrubies is very straightforward. You can find us there. Same with Instagram, Instagram.com/thejackrubies. Facebook.com/thejackrubies. What you might expect it to be. And we have a Bandcamp page too as well. So all those things.
All right. Thank you so much once again. This has been such a fun hour.
Yeah. Thank you very much for having me on the show. I really enjoyed chatting to all of you.
And I certainly hope that some gigs will get worked out. And if that were to happen and you make it to Atlanta, I will definitely be there.
Yeah, that's fabulous. Well, we'll definitely keep you posted on that.
So we will be back next week. And until then, Stephanie, why don't you kick us off with where people can find you?
You can find me on Facebook at Stephanie Seymour Music. You can find me on Instagram at @their_r_birds. And I have a website, therearebirds.com. And you can find me on Bandcamp under my name, Stephanie Seymour. And of course, on all these streaming platforms like Spotify and stuff like that.
All right, Anthony.
You can also find me on the Watchers in the Fourth Dimension podcast, watching our way through all of Doctor Who from 1963 until now. We are on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and all of those other places wherever you like to get your podcasts. And you can also follow us on social media at Watches4D on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, or X, or whatever the fuck it's called this week.
Right.
And you can also find me personally on Instagram at Englishman in ATL.
Rob, how about you?
So you can find me on Facebook or the Twitter X planetary mess that is, also on Post under my name. And you can find me on the radio on Wednesday nights on KDHX 88.1 FM in St. Louis, streaming at kdhx.org. So you can listen to that on the archive stream whenever you want. It's there for you to listen to whenever. Also, I host a show on Louder Than War Radio on Monday nights from 6 to 8 Greenwich Mean Time. And then that's 1 to 3 Eastern, 12 to 2 Central. It's called Antics. You can listen to that there. And I'm also on the Weekend Justice podcast for needcoffee.com.
All right. And I've got a website that catches all of my nonsense in one place, and that is Cosmic Creative. KOZMICCreative.com. You can find my books. You can find my podcasts. And I don't know, maybe I'll put out a coloring book and you can find that there too. I don't know. So we will be back soon. Hope you'll stick around with us. Until then, take care. Keep rocking on. And we'll see you soon.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Okay, we are at a little over an hour, and that sounds like a good place to end. Is there any other question that we must ask that we didn't get to?
I feel like I asked my question.
For you guys or for me? I'm
Well, do you have any questions for us?
when are you going to reform the band?
Yeah, Stephanie.
I'll start the band.
Well, we should start a band.
Stephanie's on drums, right?
Well, yeah. I'm a drummer too, so it could be a two.
Oh, you're a drummer band. Too. You're both drummers. Okay.
Yeah, and our other co-host, who isn't here tonight, Anthony, is the bass player. So,
yeah,
I guess that leaves Rob on the vocals.
Rhythm session. Yeah, yeah.
I lead singer. You're lead singer, Rob. It's left.
Good God!
All right.
Good God.